Maybe it was the Bichelle Beaujolais, 1970, but in an AM upstairs on Crescent Avenue, I had a conversation with K.C. Bird. We were discussing rhythm, and I said, rhythm makes everything move, the seasons swing. It backs up the elements, like walking Paul Chambers' fingers. My worthy constituent, Bird said, the universe is a spiraling big band in a polka-dotted speakeasy, effusively generating new light, every one-night stand. We agreed that nature can't do without rhythm, but rhythm can get along without nature.
That's Ishmael Reed reading an excerpt from his poem, Rhythm in Philosophy. Ishmael is a Renaissance man. Besides being a poet, he's also a novelist, essayist, songwriter, playwright, and a jazz pianist. Ishmael's probably best known as a satirist. He often examines American politics and culture through novels like Mumbo Jumbo, The Terrible Twos, and Conjugating Hindi. Ishmael has earned 2 nominations for the National Book Award and 1 for a Pulitzer Prize. He's also received a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. One of Reed's most important innovations was Neo-Hoodoo. He took the spirit of the African religion Vodun and combined it with contemporary issues in America.
In the 1960s, black writers departed from imitation. For example, James Baldwin was influenced by Henry James to the extent that he wrote a critical piece about Henry James' work, and Henry James' son sent him a portrait of his father. Of course, Henry James was a wannabe Anglo because he tried to smother his Irish background. He's a terrible anti-Semite at the same time. And if you read Ralph Ellison, he also is indebted to Hemingway and Eliot, although I found nothing in The Invisible Man that traces him to T.S. Eliot. But I think he had to say that in order to gain admission to the club at the time. 1960s, black writers broke with that. I mean, they began to study Arabic, the indigenous African languages. I went into something called, you know, black folklore, using that and trying to put a postmodernist bent or a slant on black folklore. And people went into other different directions trying to find something that was more connected to their roots. Amir Baraka was a genius at that because he, abandoned the so-called eloquence of the language and wrote in the style of the streets, of street talk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which you have been doing for a long time as well.
Well, I mix it all up.
Right, yes. A couple of years ago, you wrote a play called The Haunting of Lin-Manuel Miranda. Can you tell us a bit about the play and why you wrote it?
Well, I thought that the presentation of Alexander Hamilton on Broadway didn't square with my research. And I think, actually, although I got a lot of criticism for the play by those who were Hamilton fans, Hamill fans, they call themselves, the discussion was begun by 3 women historians, Lyra Montenegro, Nancy Eisenberg, and Michelle DuRoss, especially Michelle DuRoss. She takes on those historians who put out the myth that Hamilton was some kind of abolitionist. One by one, I said it reminded me of George Foreman on the afternoon that he fought 5 opponents at one time. You know, it's devastating. So the women historians were the ones who began the argument. I merely staged the argument. And so the point of the play was that, although it was criticized by people who had seen it, especially on Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR, it was really subjected to ridicule, even though they hadn't seen the play.
A writer named Ishmael Reed really hates the musical Hamilton, because he says that by making Hamilton himself a cool hip-hop verse-dropping immigrant hero, it covers up Hamilton's real life as a slave owner and generally bad guy. So Ishmael Reed wrote a play called The Haunting of Lin-Manuel Miranda, in which the author of Hamilton, played by an actor, that's the most beloved musical of modern times, he's visited by ghosts of people from history telling him how wrong he is. That's the play. In the end, of course, we guess he'd be visited by a ghost of Lin-Manuel Future who says, don't worry about all this. I am so rich.
And so my point was that all of us are misled by the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And that even though Lin-Miranda had used that one book as a basis for his play, there were other sources that he could have consulted. Even Ron Chernow says that Hamilton might have owned slaves. Now, since then, the Schuyler Historical Site, his father was Philip Schuyler, the general in Albany. They published a piece that was repeated in the New York Times, or republished in the New York Times, that he indeed owned slaves, and bartered slaves. So I thought that I would respond to this billion-dollar production with a sort of like a rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, is there one real historical fact that isn't covered in the musical, that something about Hamilton, something maybe that he said that really kind of really bothers you more than anything else, aside from the fact that he owned slaves?
He was into private property.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his ideas that formed the bank. The bank, Thomas Jefferson said the bank was not meant for farmers, but was meant for the rich, the 1%. But he said that he accused the British of stealing Negroes from their owners. So he, in his writings, he sort of like ranks blacks along with cattle and horses, like farm property, equipment.
Yeah.
And there's very little about his attitude toward Native Americans. Both he and Washington believed the Native Americans should be exterminated. And I ran across a letter that Hamilton wrote where he congratulates the vigilante mob for massacring a Native American village.
Mm. How have audiences responded to your play, The Haunting of Lin-Manuel Miranda? And also, I'm curious, have you ever received feedback from Lin-Manuel?
He hasn't answered my criticisms or the criticisms of the play, but the play has been published by Powerhouse Books, which is a subsidiary of Simon & Schuster, and it's doing very well. I think it's number 15 bestseller on the list of musicals.
Oh, that's great.
Musicals and plays. So they have a billion-dollar enterprise going on here. I think we spent about $50,000. So it's a real David versus Goliath conflict. And when the Disney thing happened, we followed them all over the world.
Mm.
Europe, China, all over. Whenever they mentioned the Disney version of Hamilton, they mentioned our rebuttal.
Mm. You're part of the longest continuing music poetry collaborations. They're called the Conjure Projects. How did this come about?
According to Kip Hanrahan, he wanted me to write a text for Cecil Taylor and Brezhnikov, the dancer. And that was supposed to be the collaboration that Kip Hanrahan was going to arrange. But I think something happened where I think Bill Gunn was supposed to direct, and I think somebody said that they wanted more power or something. It fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Kip Hanrahan did, there were some songs and poetry from my second book of poetry, Conjure, that he sent to noted musicians like Alan Toussaint and Taj Mahal, Carla Bley, Steve Swallow, and David Murray, and invited them to write compositions to go with the poetry and the songs. And that's how the first Conjure event came about. There was a concert at the public theater, and then after the concert, the first album was produced, Conjure One. And since Conjure One, there's been Conjure Two, Conjure Three. We did performances in Europe. We did a tour of Europe and performed at the Blue Note in Tokyo.
Wow. As you mentioned, your poems and lyrics have been set to music by such great musicians as Taj Mahal and Alan Toussaint. And one of these poems is called When I Die, I Will Go to Jazz. Can you tell us a bit about this poem?
I was replying to Ted Jones, whose famous poem is Jazz is My Religion. And if you go to YouTube, you can find that poem. I tried to duplicate the rhythms of jazz on the page, and it's got a sort of like a metaphysical question, whether you want to go to paradise or whether you want to go to a place where there's like 1,000 years of jam sessions.
Yeah, exactly.
People tell me that this poem was read at funerals.
Oh, that makes sense.
Of jazz fans.
As Ted Jones would say, let them go to heaven or let them go to hell. When I die, I want to go to jazz. Who needs Gabriel when we got Clifford Clark, Lee and Vix? Distinguished mix. And Prez and Billy sit on their thrones in their courtware pork pies, gardenias, and checkered vests. And the tempo of the place is like Denzel Best. With Magus and Brown, doing the chores on bass. A place where Satch is Avatar, and Sun Ra, Gil, and Kelm are resident sages. And among those on trumpet are Fats and Hot Lips Page.
This poem has been sort of like framed on a wall by the SF Jazz Center. Hmm. And it's in an alley next to the Jazz Center on Franklin that's called Raise Up Off Me Alley. And Raise Up Off Me comes from the title of the memoir by Hampton Hawes, a pianist, a jazz pianist, who was in Lexington Prison Hospital, and he's pardoned by JFK. I think JFK said all the guy wants to do is play jazz.
Are there any particular musical pieces from the Conjure Project that you think really strengthened the messages of the poems?
One of my favorites is Alan Toussaint's Skydive. That was really a poem that was really therapeutic for me. I was going through a difficult, dark time, and that poem sort of like rescued me from that despair.
In these downhill days of a hard-hearted decade, jetting through the world, our tails on fire. You can't always count on things opening up for you. Know when to let go. Learn how to fall.
You're a Renaissance man, a novelist, poet, essayist, songwriter, playwright, jazz pianist. How does your work in these various genres cross-pollinate from one medium to the other?
Well, I think I was telling Carla Blank, who's my partner for 50 years the other day, that my writing plays has strengthened my ability to orchestrate scenes in my novels. It's like I'm able to bring in different sensory things like sound and other things that you learn from writing, seeing plays being performed and writing plays. So I think they sort of overlap. Sometimes a poem will tell you that it wants to be a novel. So Flight to Canada, for which I coined the term neo-slave narrative, I wish I'd never done that because now it's become a big industry. So Flight to Canada was a poem. It began as a poem. And then when I studied the poem, I said, well, you know, you got a novel here. Mm. And so the poem is the first writing that you get in the novel.
Yeah. Did it take you very long? Did you write the whole poem before you decided this should be a novel, or did you get just partway?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did. The poem is based upon a letter that one of the fugitive slaves wrote. When the master tells him to return to the plantation, he tells him what he can do and where to go, and what he can do it himself. And so that's that was the basis of the poem.
Yeah. Your former student, Frank B. Wilderson III, has written a book called Afro-Pessimism, and he makes the case in the book that there is something essential about the suffering of Black people that can't be reconciled with the suffering of other people. I'm curious to know, what do you think of Frank's idea?
Well, I think he's got a point there that, you know, multiculturalism has become to mean everybody but Blacks, you know. What Frank Wilderson is saying, I believe, is that you can't rely upon what he calls the junior allies. Whites are not the only racists in this country, you know. Mm-hmm. There are racist attitudes that are embraced by a number of communities, which are, on the surface, seem to be in alignment with Blacks. And I wrote a novel called Conjugating Hindi, which didn't receive very many reviews here. I discussed that. The novel is about a conflict between a Black sort of like liberal professor and a right-wing Indian public intellectual. As a matter of fact, I told Jack White wanted me to write something about the Rodney King beating, and he wanted me to write something for Time magazine. What happened was we had fax machines and one page was missing, so he had to write it himself. But I told him that in 20 years, Blacks will look back to miss the days when white racism was the only racism they had to worry about.
In your novels, you've often accurately predicted the future. So what do you think the next few years here on planet Earth are going to be like?
Well, I see nothing but pessimism. there just seems to be an inability to grasp the peril that the earth is in. I mean, of course, the earth will continue for, you know, at least maybe another billion years, but it may not be continue with this species. And I'm just wondering, is there some kind of death wish in our DNA that would have this happen? And so my new story I'm writing, it ends with one of the characters speculating about the future of the earth. The character talks about the UN report that talks about approaching the point of no return. Mm-hmm. And the character says, well, the problem with the report is that most of the leaders of the world can't read. This is kind of leadership that's, you know, just taking the world to ruin.
Yeah. Yeah, very well said. Ishmael Reed, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. It was a real pleasure and such an honor. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Ishmael Reed is a poet, novelist, essayist, and a playwright. You can find out more about Ishmael and his work at wpr.org/beta.
Whenever I'm having a bad writing day, I tweet out that picture of John Turturro from Barton Fink, where he thinks like the wallpaper is peeling off the walls of his hotel room.
Megan Abbott joins us to talk about her latest novel, The Turnout, which takes us inside the competitive world of ballet. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.